This is the eHealth Radio Network, your source for health advice on demand. And now your host, Eric Michaels.
This is Eric Michaels, and once again, you have tuned into the eHealth Radio Network and the Addiction Prevention and Health News channels. Make sure you connect with us on Facebook to receive the latest programming for your convenience simply at eHealth Radio. Today, we are speaking with Andrew Berkey, the CEO and founder of Life of Purpose, the only substance and disorder treatment facility in the nation located on a college campus. Andrew, thanks for joining us here today on eHealth Radio.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Yeah, good to have you as well. Tell me a little bit about how you got into the addiction and treatment line of work, for starters.
So I basically got to it through my own substance use disorder. I had a number of treatment episodes and relapses after them, beginning when I was 17. So I overdosed 5 days after I turned 17. I was in a program for a year, got out, relapsed, ran around for a little bit, went back to a different program, was there for 9 months, got out, relapsed, and then the last time that I'm the current recovery episode that I'm in, I got sober 3 weeks after I turned 21, and subsequently, got shuffled around from a couple different treatment centers, and ended up down here in South Florida at a facility that actually provided excellent services, clinical services, and the one sort of disconnect that occurred was at the very tail end of it, my parents, who were obviously very tired and distressed of dealing with me by this point, were told, you really shouldn't let him return to college until he has 5 years of contiguous abstinence. And, they're desperate to save me. And so they took that recommendation, which I clearly fundamentally disagree with. So I worked my little early recovery jobs, and then eventually got into sort of the very bottom tier position of substance use disorder treatment as a behavioral health tech. I went back to school, got my bachelor's degree, went for a master's in social work, and over the course of that time, I was sort of moving up from tech to case manager to therapist, and then post graduate school, I set up Life of Purpose, and really the reason I created this is because it all of the research strongly supports level of education, meaning and purpose in life, hence the name, self-esteem. They're massive insulating factors against relapse and return to use, and so it's actually a very flawed argument to say, listen, we shouldn't put kids in school because of the fact that there's drugs and alcohol in school, because, that's just like American youth culture. There's drugs and alcohol everywhere, every concert, every club, a large number of coffee tables located in between sofas and Xboxes are potentially recovery hostile environments, and arguably more recovery hostile than like your, statistics class in college. And so, it's really, if you want people to be able to achieve long-term sustainable recovery, you have to empower them to build a life that is worth staying clean and sober for. That's been my experience. I'm about to pick up 14 years in 2 weeks. And, over the course of my recovery, education more than any other single factor has empowered me to create like a really, meaningful and rewarding life.
Thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate that. Tell us about Life of Purpose and the type of treatment programs that you do offer.
Okay, so Life of Purpose is an academically focused substance use disorder treatment program. So rather than sort of the standard models where you're trying to provide services and help everyone, I've basically made a conscious decision that we're going to be extremely, extremely good at helping, this one segment of the population, which is, younger adults, emerging adults that have, substance use disorder and co-occurring academic disruption. They didn't complete high school. They went to college and dropped out. They completed college but couldn't do grad school, anything in that range. But they sort of have to be in a position where they're going to be able to like move forward and better themselves through education. So, you know, we deal with everything from, I actually carry adolescent licensure as well, which I exclusively use for 17-year-olds. So we deal with everything from kind of like high school seniors that are coming off the tracks to, you know, failure to launch cases and guys that are like 35 and, you know, have been in 25 different treatment centers. But there's this common thread of academic disruption. And so, you know, we're able to provide services that are superior to that population at the sacrifice of being just a wildly inappropriate placement for, you know, anyone that doesn't sort of fall into that demographic. So like 65-year-old retired Vietnam veteran, we would be terrible at treating, and so they would obviously never be here as a result of that. And so what you do is I have it structured so, you know, they have their therapist and it's all master's level clinicians and the clinical director, Eric Bricker, you know, came over from a 10-year position as a senior clinical administrator for the Seminole Tribe. So, I mean, we've got incredibly, incredibly good and talented clinical services, and we're very dual diagnosis capable. I've, you know, recruited one of the therapists from the VA and one of the therapists from South County Mental Health and, you know, a couple from, like, college counseling centers and things like that. So they're very good at dealing with this population. But then in addition to that, there's an entire secondary tier of degreed professionals, which are the academically focused case managers. And so that's, I would say that's the really like differentiating factor in our treatment model, in that, you know, a client comes in and these case managers are working with them from the very beginning. So they'll do, you know, sort of more typical case management stuff in terms of like coordinating with lawyers and straightening out legal issues, or, you know, dealing with community service and obviously medical appointments and things along those lines. But on top of that, they will basically initially assess the sort of academic standing of the individual. And so then, you know, depending on what the person does, if they want to return to the school that they just, you know, failed out of, or if they want to go to a different school, or if they want to come down here, there's kind of a couple different options that become available. And so, you know, the first thing they'll do is essentially assess the situation and try to clean up transcripts. So, you know, they'll pull all the D's and F's that are possible off of the college transcript of the individual that is being treated, and then they'll register them for classes. You know, if they want to go to brick-and-mortar schools that are down here and receive sort of the support services and infrastructure that we have in and around this campus, then, you know, they can go to Florida Atlantic University. Palm Beach State has a campus right on Florida Atlantic University's campus, so they can actually register there, and all of those credits will transfer over later. You know, we're not putting people in, like, five classes. You know, you put them in one class, but you're registering for a class or two even when they're still receiving inpatient services. So they're literally like leaving group, going to class, you know, being transported across campus, going into the class, coming out of the class, and then coming back and can, you know, meeting with their therapist or psychiatrist or whomever. You know, and so you're basically, what you're doing is you're creating an additional outcome measurement. Lynn University is another option that's down here. That's like 0.75 miles. And then of course, like UM and, Barry and Nova, and there's a fair number of schools down here. But where, you know, what you do is when the individual is like receiving these services, you are actually leveraging their academic performance to help support their recovery, right? So once their transcripts are cleaned up and they're registered for classes, then the nature of the case management shifts. And what they're doing at that point is we're literally tracking every single assignment that happens in every single class, so that you can do concurrent clinical and academic interventions, right? So you're like 95, here's a pat on the back. 75, here is, you know, your tutor. 85, this is where the math lab is. 65, like, you know, what's going on? Are you, you're clearly decompensating if you're really like falling apart at this point in time on this test, or like, you know, we need to provide some services to support you in getting to where you need to be. And so, as a result of that, as a result of the fact that you have this additional outcome measurement, you can basically build up a case for the individual that their life in recovery looks significantly better than their life in active addiction. It's not that they don't go and get the job, but it fundamentally changes the way you perceive yourself as a person, right? Because, you know, as you transition them to lower levels of care or to our recovery student housing and sort of different assets that we have in the area to provide a full continuum of care and support service. What you have is you have accessibility to school creates a identity, right? So if you're taking one class and working a 30-hour-a-week job, you're a college student with an appropriate college student job. If you're just working a 30 or 40-hour-a-week job, you know, at Chipotle or whatever, you're a burrito roller, and you know you're a burrito roller, and as a result of that, you're going to be more inclined to look around and basically be like, you know, I'm failing, you know, which was sort of my personal experience. People are like, oh, you're doing so great in your recovery, and I'm like, no, I'm actually doing terrible at life, and even though I'm maintaining my abstinence, I work in a call room, and I don't feel good about myself in early recovery, and so as a result of that, you're faced with like a higher degree of, you know, cravings and depression and sort of some of the issues that go along with early recovery. That's the brief overview.
And I also heard that Life of Purpose recently joined the MAP Recovery Network. Can you tell us about the network and how it benefits and what Life of Purpose is doing in that regard?
Sure. So MAP's phenomenal. What, you know, one of the things that is very problematic is there's a couple different competing treatment models that exist, and most of them are primarily focused on sort of inpatient treatment and intensive outpatient treatment, like post inpatient treatment. But you know, really, if you want someone to be successful over a longer period of time, what you need is you essentially need to have a taper down of services over an extended period of time, where the individual still, you know, has a high degree of autonomy and is able to, you know, build a life and build their self-esteem and all of these things, but you're still providing support services. So MAP fits perfectly into that clinical philosophy in the sense that it provides this very, you know, low-level support service for an extremely long period of time at a very low price point. I mean, so it becomes economically viable for the family because I'm literally able to basically just dovetail this service onto the cost of treatment for the family so that they're not paying out of pocket for it, and they're still receiving, you know, a year plus of these support services post-treatment. And then that in conjunction with, like, the money we donate to the universities and the support that we provide in terms of, like, building up collegiate recovery communities on the university campuses themselves, in conjunction with you know, our involvement in recovery advocacy with young people in recovery, who we also financially are contributors to, and their EPIC programming. All of these sort of these services become immensely valuable when the person is no longer in treatment and they're working a job and they're in school and they have you know, essentially more rope to screw up with. Right, because you can keep anyone sober for a short period of time in a bubble, and you know it's very easy. Like when someone's when they're in inpatient services, you can essentially you know, provide like structure and support that prevents them from using. But the larger issue is like what happens after treatment, right? So how do you get through your first year? How do you get through, you know, year two, year three? Because that's where there's a much higher risk because of the fact that you don't have the same level of support services. So, you know, I'm incredibly excited about MAP. I think the services they provide are absolutely phenomenal. And the other thing that, you know, just from a sort of you know, company philosophy standpoint, MAP is obviously very research oriented, which we are as well. Like, you know, we donated to Florida Atlantic University. You know, we donated like $100,000 to them, and they set up the Office of Substance Misuse, Mental Health, and Recovery Research, which is a recovery research office. We're donating to University of North Texas, where we're setting up a second facility in January. And again, you know, we're setting up these recovery research offices because, you know, when you're looking at a pandemic on a national scale that is killing someone at a rate of faster than one every 10 minutes and has an economic impact of $600 billion per year as a result of substance use disorder in this country, it's insane that we don't have massive support infrastructure for young people in early recovery built into our schools, built into our communities. And the only way we're ever going to get there is through research, is through recovery research, because we have to have, it's not sufficient to just say, hey, this is a problem. You have to present, here's a solution, that's been published in a peer-reviewed journal, and we are going to leverage this solution to try to affect legislation to provide better support infrastructure for young people. So MAP has that philosophy. I have that philosophy. Our company has that philosophy. And I think, and we're certainly not the only ones. And I think there is a growing number of organizations that are really, looking at this situation from a more global perspective. And are saying, look, it's not okay to just keep sending people in and out of treatment. We have to provide support services post-treatment if we want people to succeed. That's the entire structure of MAP. So they're phenomenal. I'm super, super excited to be partnered with them.
Today we are speaking with Andrew Berkey, the CEO and founder of Life of Purpose, the only substance use disorder treatment facility in the nation, located on a college campus here on eHealth Radio's Addiction Prevention and Health News channels, a part of the eHealth Radio network. Andrew, what can we do to bring more attention to this chronic disease?
So, in terms of bringing attention, raising awareness, reduction of stigma, it's a very multifaceted approach. So there's several things that can take place. One, obviously, programs like the one you're running right now are tremendous in terms of, moving the conversation forward and moving the conversation from a place where it is strictly, problem-oriented and problem-focused, right? And everyone in America knows that there's a drug problem. Everyone in America knows that there is a heroin pandemic. You would have to just be, literally living under a rock to not be aware of the fact that these are problems. But in terms of bringing attention to the chronic disease, it's not even just about bringing attention to it. It's about bringing attention to the solution to it. And so, I touched base about that a little bit before, in terms of funding, publishing, and implementing research through academia and higher education, through organizations like MAP, from the private sector, that's really how we push forward the solution. And then, of course, obviously, rallies and marches, and I was up in D.C. for the Unite to Face Addiction rally concert that was on the National Mall there on October 4th. Things along those lines on the local level, the marches that they have in Philadelphia, probably turn out 25,000-30,000 people. It's happening. There's a shift going on nationally where we are no longer really looking at substance use disorder as the moral failing that it has been perceived inaccurately so to be really for decades. And we're starting to say, look, this is this is hitting across every single segment of the spectrum, every single subculture within our society. There is no community that is unaffected by substance use disorder. So we just need to keep the conversation going, and we really need to shift the conversation and continue to shift the conversation because there's actually a lot that's been done to do that towards, how are we going to solve this instead of why is this so horrible? Which is, it's important. We should talk about, acknowledge the fact that there's a problem, but I feel that the problem has been acknowledged and we are now at a stage, as a society, as a, the respective industries, the treatment industry, the medical industry, which is much larger, insurance industries, which are also much larger, that, we really need to talk about implementation of a solution. And the implementation of the solution, all of the research strongly, strongly supports, irrespective of which segment it's coming out of, that aftercare services, support services, community, belonging, they're strong, self-esteem, education, they're massive insulating factors against just having this incredibly high recidivism rate that has historically existed when it comes to people with substance use disorders, just being sort of like in and out of support services, and not even just treatment. I'm talking about in and out of emergency rooms, in and out of psychiatric wards. The whole supportive infrastructure is strained because of the fact that we provide we provide services in the crisis, but we don't provide support services post-crisis to prevent the crisis from reoccurring. As an industry, obviously, I mean, myself, I do, MAP does, the collegiate recovery communities do, but on a larger, more macro scale, like it is not being done at a sufficient level yet.
And lastly, what advice would you give someone who is suffering from this disease or a family member trying to find help for their loved one?
So there's a bunch of different approaches that an individual can use to receive support services. Obviously, you know, a lot of people go to online in terms of like finding support services. If you have someone that is in this age demographic, you're certainly more than welcome to contact us, which can be done at www.lifeofpurposetreatment, all spelled out, lifeofpurposetreatment.com, or call us at 1-888-PURPOSE. But beyond that, I mean, there's people that sort of like don't meet this criteria. You know, if you're dealing with like impaired professionals, if you're dealing with true adolescents, 13, 14 year olds, there's a lot of good services out there, and one of the excellent ways to sort of navigate through that system is with either an education consultant or an interventionist, because you essentially have someone that is working for you, advocating for you. Therapists in private practice are also phenomenal in terms of connecting you with services, and a lot of times it's an easier approach than trying to fight it out, because the real difference between like having an interventionist or a therapist or an ed consultant involved in getting support services for a loved one who's struggling is you have somewhere to go when that sort of brief window of willingness opens up, right? So talking about myself personally, I had plenty of situations where my parents were like, we would have the arguments and fight it out and scream and the whole deal. And, I would have that brief moment of willingness to like get some help. And they would be like, oh, finally, we got them to like, be rational for a second. But then they had nowhere to send me. Right? So be like, okay, well, we just fought about this for the last 5 hours. We'll deal with this in the morning. And by the morning, I was back to being very resistant to receiving any sort of help. And so that's why, the only times that I was ever able to actually get to treatment and get the support services, that I really desperately needed and that my family really desperately needed, is when there was external support involved, when it wasn't just like my parents trying to save me, no matter how much they loved me, but there were professionals involved, so there were therapists in private practice and things along those lines. So those would be my three sort of like go-tos for any family, irrespective of whether their kid is appropriate for Life of Purpose or whether they're planning on coming here or anything, is get an ed consultant, an interventionist, or a clinician in private practice involved in the case early on.
Well, Andrew, it certainly has been good to have had you, especially from your personal experience in all these regards. Really helpful information. Folks, it is lifeofpurposetreatment.com for more information. Andrew, thanks so much for your time today here on eHealth Radio.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
And you as well. We've been speaking with Andrew Berkey, the CEO and founder of Life of Purpose, the only substance use disorder treatment facility in the nation located on a college campus. And one more time, the website of reference is lifeofpurposetreatment.com. And this has been Eric Michaels, and you've been listening to eHealth Radio and the Addiction Prevention and Health News channels, a part of the eHealth Radio Network. And we do thank you for listening. And until next time, enjoy.
Thanks for tuning in to the eHealth Radio Network. For more information or to subscribe to this podcast, visit eHealthRadioNetwork.com.